Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope you're all having a good night out there. I have been rummaging through Facebook for some time and clicking on links, winding up in all kinds of different places. And I want to alert people to another portion of the Murphyville tonight concerning testing and the National Mental Health Policy Laboratory or something like that that gets invented under Title I of Murphy's legislation. But if you'd like to call in and talk about anything in anything, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. The toll-free guest call-in line, if you need a toll-free number, is area code 855-346-3351. It's area code 855-346-3351. So in H.R. 3717, which obviously I am opposing, also opposing, let's just keep it on H.R. 3717 right now. Under Section 1, there's a whole new policy arm that's created that I'll get to in a little while. But on page 24, they describe the training program for certain primary care physicians and talk about it in terms of purposes of subsection A. The purpose described in this subsection with respect to a grant awarded to a state under the grant program is for the state to establish a training program to train primary care physicians in, and then they list a whole series of things that potentially they should be testing, that they're going to train physicians to test. And so these include, one, approved standardized behavioral health screening tools, including the Age and Stages Questionnaire, or ASQSE. And the Ages and Stages Questionnaire is a questionnaire that is filled out either by parents or by physicians or somewhere in between that, of all of the developmental milestones that young people go through in their early, from birth to toddler age or probably older than that. And anyway, so it's maybe it's one a year for all I know. But it's multiple developmental stepping stones that they're saying is part of the what will be, I think, ultimately paid for and part of this grant program that is in the Murphyville. The second thing that they list is the brief infant toddler social and emotional assessment, and then screening for substance abuse known as CAR, Relax, Alone, Forget, Friends, Trouble, or Craft. These are all different screening instruments for different, you know, quote-unquote social and behavioral, mental health things. And then when you get to page 25, and line 1 of page 25 is D, screening for autism known as Modified Checklist for Autism in Toddlers, MCAT. And so I went and I found a version of this modified checklist for autism in toddlers, revised, and on Autism Speaks, they link right to it. And I put in answers varying for multiple different ways that I would have answered questions. And so ultimately, all the way up until 3, there are 20 questions, and whatever their scaling is on this, if you get 3 of these questions quote-unquote, wrong. It puts your child at moderate risk for medium risk. And so three wrong on this quote-unquote 20-question test. Maybe I should even before that, I should read some of the examples of the questions here so you understand what I'm talking about. Does your child like climbing on things? Does your child play pretend or make-believe? Have you ever wondered if your child might be deaf? I was tested for, they thought that I was deaf when I was a child, I was told recently. Because I didn't respond when I was called, you know. And so then if you point at something across the room, does your child look at it? Does your child point with one finger to ask for something or to get help? Does your child make unusual finger movements near his or her eyes? Is your child interested in other children? Does your child respond when you call his or her name? When you smile at your child, does he or she smile back at you? Does your child get upset by everyday noises? So these are the questions, types of questions that is asked. So if you get a 3 on this score, in various ways that I answered these questions, I got up to an 11, which I believe was a high risk or something, and I must go to a doctor immediately. But if you get a 3 on this, I'm just going to read from, this is the Modified Checklist for Autism and Toddlers Revised, MCHAT-R Risk Score 3. And I think I selected things like doesn't look in the eye, maybe doesn't respond when their name is called or something like that. And so this says score indicates medium risk. You should take your doctor, you should take your child to a healthcare professional to administer the follow-up interview, which is designed to go with the 20 questions. The interview can be found at mchatscreen.com. If the score is still a 2 or higher, then you should make an appointment for further evaluation and seek early intervention services. And so this is when Murphy talks about improving screening processes, and Barber talks about intervention and training and screening. That test that I just discussed is one of the tests on their approved list of things that they would, in this bill, support training programs for certain primary care physicians, for the state to establish them. And then other things are like the parents' evaluation of developmental status, screening for depression known as patient health... the screening for depression... If it wasn't so sad, it really would be funny. Is known as Patient Health Questionnaire 9, the PHQ-9. The Pediatric Symptom Checklist, PSC, and Pediatric Symptom Checklist, Youth Report, YPSC. The Strengths and Difficulties Questionnaire. This is the testing. This is it, folks. Not one biological test, not one brain scan, not one anything. I'm going to ask you whether or not your kid looks you in the eye when you speak to them, or smiles at you when you smile at them, and that's going to be enough for me to say that this child may have autism, and you better get to a doctor. Even if you answer and get only two right, the MCHAT-R risk score says score indicates low risk, but if the child is below 24 months, rescreen then. If you notice other behaviors or concerns, take your child to a healthcare provider. For resources in your area, a list of autism treatment network clinics and the where to get an autism diagnosis section in our state-by-state resource guide. And so you know, this is it. If you get a two, you know, you better check back in a couple of weeks and, you know, make sure that you look at all these things. And by the way, if you need to figure out where to get an autism diagnosis, we have a section for that on our website. And so this is what Murphy is pushing. This is what HR 3717 includes. All of these behavioral health, what are they calling them? Approved standardized behavioral health screening tools. And so, you know, any word about trauma in any of these, any word about anything? I mean, when you look at who the director of this new assistant secretary position under Title I of what this thing creates, when you really start to look and pick apart, it almost sounds like I was from Boston, pick apart all of what it is Murphy is putting out there. And I'm gonna walk right through this. I just want to check if anybody is waiting to talk or if you'd like to call in and talk about any of this. Area code 267-521-0167. And toll-free line is 855-346-3351. And if you're online holding and you want to talk, just make sure you hit 1 because otherwise I may not know that you're wanting to talk, and I keep on having some conflict back and forth with this thing. Okay, so as you can probably imagine, I'm here moving in between windows, right? And so where does Title I start? I think it was on page 7, maybe. The assistant, you know how these bills read, right? They all have a number panel down the left-hand side marking each of the lines 1 to 25, and then have all kinds of bizarre paragraphing off of indentations of the way things are, and they don't make it really accessible. It's, you know, a little overwhelming. And, of course, my computer is sitting here jamming. Aren't you glad you're listening to me? Okay, so I'm almost there of where the beginning of Title I starts. And this is the thing that ultimately winds up creating the laboratory. I think it's called the Mental Health Policy Laboratory. If you'd like to call in, the number's area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. Okay, I found it. So it's section 501A, the Assistant Secretary for Mental Health and Substance Use Disorders. It says, quote, A, in general, there shall be in the Department of Health and Human Services an official to be known as the Assistant Secretary for Mental Health and Substance Use Disorders, in this section referred to as the Assistant Secretary, who shall report directly to the Secretary, be appointed by the Secretary, all and on and on and on and on and on, right? And so, not that far long, it says, be selected from, so I might as well just read that one sentence because I thought it went on and on. Be appointed by the Secretary by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. And three, be selected from among individuals who, A, one, have a doctoral degree in medicine or osteopathic medicine and clinical and research experience in psychiatry. Two, graduated from an accreditation council for graduate medical education certified psychiatric residency program. And three, have an understanding of biological, psychosocial, and pharmaceutical treatments of mental illness. Or B, have a doctoral degree in psychology with clinical and research experience and understanding of biological, psychosocial, and pharmaceutical treatments of mental illness. And your relation to the SAMHSA administration is the substance abuse, the administrator of substance abuse and mental health services shall be under the supervision and direction of the assistant secretary. So what they want is to put a doctor in over the commissioner of the substance abuse and mental health services administration, who is not somebody who maybe has a legal background, as is, I think, part of the situation now, but somebody who has a medical, biopsychosocial, pharmaceutical treatment, medical, clinical research experience model. And so this is part of the problem, folks. This is, they want somebody who is a biopsychological psychiatry person running the federal government's Health and Human Services Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, overseeing the entire thing. They have, when you actually look even just at the short, the table of contents for this, the first four things that are dealt with, and it's like 20 titles long, this whole thing that Murphy has put forth, or 11, back there where it goes back to SAMHSA. But in Title One, the first four things that are done is that there's the creation of the Assistant Secretary for Mental Health and Substance Use Disorders. The second thing that's done is what they're calling an Interagency Serious Mental Illness Coordinating Committee. The third thing that's done is the outlines for the Assisted Outpatient Treatment Grant Program. And the fourth thing that's being done is the rules for telepsychiatry and primary care physician training grant program, which included in part some of those surveys like the modified child checklist for autism and toddlers revised form that is part of what they're pushing. And so why is it's not just that they're trying to shut SAMHSA down. They're trying to propel SAMHSA into being a psychiatric laboratory. I mean, this language of this mental health policy laboratory thing is in this bill that it really is like, you know, the ministry and that's what it is. Yeah, National Mental Health Policy Laboratory, and the acronym for this is NHPL. And this is, you know, going to be the collection place for data collection and dissemination and best practices as determined by, you know, the doctor or the biopsychologist that are the only people that can run SAMHSA. And this is a huge issue in values, and in part what's happened, and if I'm wrong, somebody call in and say, Lauren, you've got it wrong, because I will be the first to say, okay, good, I hope I have it wrong. But it seems that what's happening is the move of moving toward the idea that we have to start using that language, because we were so successful in outrooting language of a, you know, quote-unquote illness model that and replacing it with things like people who have lived experience or trauma kinds of things, that we were so good at getting rid of the illness model and having those things put in there that now if people don't start using the illness language again, they're not going to have any hope for any kind of funding. And so so there we are again. And what this Murphy bill, you know, whatever reason people are fighting it, I'm glad people are fighting it, But what some of the things that they can come to consensus on is what concerns me. And Barber and the Democrats have no problem with early intervention and screening and prevention and training. I mean, one of the things that they're supporting in the Murphy bill, they specifically talk about two different kinds of programs, the RAISE, the Recovery After Initial Schizophrenia Episode Project, and the North American Prodrome Longitudinal Study. And, you know, this idea of going to prodromal kind of stuff and doing preventative, quote-unquote, schizophrenia work on, you know, and going through this idea that it, you know, lays dormant for years and then comes alive or whatever, however they want to put it. I mean, it's just so scary. If you have something to say, please call area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And the toll-free call-in line, if you need it, is area code 855-346-3351. It's 855-346-3351. There are a few people online, and so I'm just going to open up a line, and if you'd like to talk, your line is open. Okay, I'm going to guess that you're just going to be listening. Okay, so anyway, this Murphy bill is a real, real issue. And so the expansiveness of what this does is just horrifying. And then yesterday I briefly mentioned about the Veterans Court. It says, in the case of a Veterans Treatment Court provided under Section 1, has been diagnosed with or manifests obvious signs of mental illness or substance abuse disorder or co-occurring mental illness and substance abuse disorder. So there's this special court for veterans that combines criminal justice, mental health, and substance abuse and veteran service agencies. So it's, that's what they're looking for. So they want training programs, the Veterans Assistance Program is what it falls under, and there's all kinds of, I'm just having some struggle getting on this page. There's all kinds of that's what happened. My online just crashed, so give me a moment and hopefully that I'll be able to get back. I'm not even sure if you can still hear me. But let's see. I think I can still do it. The whole idea that whatever it says in the Murphy bill, it's a million times worse than what's being presented by the bulk of the industry around what they're wiping out. What they're replacing it with is just absolutely irresponsible and heinous and far-reaching, and the amount of people that are going to be affected is just really unreal by how many people are going to be affected. I'm still wondering if you can hear me because my Firefox froze. But let's see if we can just get everything restored and back to business. But how are they doing this to, the idea of creating special courts for veterans that are going to combine criminal justice, mental health, and substance abuse services it's so bad, and I don't think that people realize how dangerous some of this can be. And so I think that we need to continue to fight out against it and speak out against it and be able... Oh, look, you're all still there. Okay, good. And really find our power inside of this to not only talk about how this affects the current system or the pure jobs or, whether or not SAMHSA remains as it is, and really address all of these monstrous changes that they're planning on putting in under Murphy's new bill. I mean, this is really of a great concern. They also change like the way that everything gets paid for, and but the very third thing that is addressed in this bill is involuntary outpatient commitment and setting the standards for what's going to be. But that's all just in Title I, right? And so, like, in Title IV, for example, there's all of these Department of Justice reforms of all kinds, and assisted outpatient treatment is addressed again in Section 403, first in Section 103 of Title I, and then in Section 403 of Title IV. And I think it may even be addressed one other time throughout it, yeah. Again, under Title VII, under Community Mental Health Services Block Grant Reform. And, that this is, the whole new groups of people that they're going after, all wide, expanding access, Title X, expanding access to care through healthcare professional volunteerism. And so then looking at liability protections for health cares and volunteers at community health centers. So liability from what? From people being able to sue them for not being able to do a good job? I mean, what's the liability for? For community centers? Why community centers? Is that more of like the drumbeat that, of the association of, in danger, case of danger to others or something like that, that they can't be sued. And then all kinds of issues around children and violence, children with serious emotional disturbances, comprehensive community mental health services for children with serious emotional disturbances, and then children and violence. Again, nothing about trauma, nothing about changing society, nothing about anything, and certainly nothing about alternatives. They are interested in the biomedical model and the biomedical model alone. And so this is a big issue. I mean, I guess on some levels, I did wind up like doing search terms for certain things like electroconvulsive treatment or ECT, and it did not turn anything up under electroconvulsive treatment or ECT. But what it did turn up was things like electronic health records, and so this is another major issue that we really need to be concerned about, because it's not only that they're on a federal level changing all of the rules about everything that has been done for the last 30 years in trying to improve the horrid conditions of psychiatry and psychiatric places, but they're now going full force ahead with the fraud that this kind of stuff works, that these psychiatric drugs work, that psychiatry has answers, and that, you know, the real cruel people are the people who are letting people, like, wind up in jails, like me, who speak out against psychiatry and what it is they're doing, and that we're cruel and not understanding because, you know, because people are winding up in jail or whatever. So my response to that is, why aren't you changing, like, laws? Why aren't you changing, if you're changing laws, why aren't you changing the laws that would eliminate some of these people winding up in jail? Like trespassing laws, where somebody is trying to find some place to sleep because they don't have any money to have some place to sleep. Or petty crime laws, or, you know, when somebody is, like, you know, trying to eat or survive or something. So I think that there are so many alternatives that could be being done, and instead they're saying that if somebody is homeless, for example, and doesn't have any money to afford a place to be able to live on a consistent basis, that somehow a pill is going to resolve that. How is a pill going to resolve an economic problem? As Joe from Colorado says, you know, well, here's a pill. Well, how do you live in a pill? Like, how is a pill going to solve an economic problem? This is such a crime that is being committed against this country, and that the people that are involved in this should be held responsible for the conspiracy that they are putting together, the way that they are colluding with each other in order to massively control huge segments of the population, just total social control, total overreach of how it is that it's going to happen, and this legitimization. I mean, as any, just as an American or anybody from any country, that the Americans can get away with this, that the lies that are being perpetrated in order to have this get carried through, as if there is an ounce, as if there is a shred of evidence of any biological you know, basis of what it is they're talking about. And quite frankly, even if there was, it's still a violation of human rights. And so why on any level are as a government, at the national, at the federal level, why are there, like, being put in national mental health laws? Mental health laws. This is a crime against the citizens of the United States and the people of the world, because everybody is affected by this. Again, if you want to call in and talk to me, it's area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. That's 855-346-3351. There's this every town. Have you heard of this? Where did it go? Oh, because my computer crashed. I lost that website. Hold on. I'll find it. Easy enough. It's every town something or other. Closing the gaps, fatal gaps, and it's based off of a report, Closing the Gaps, every town's new report on the background check system. Anybody know who read this? I have a feeling that this is a report that was done by somebody who's deeply involved with all of this mental health stuff, but I can't be sure, so I don't want to say anything that would be totally misleading. But in this every town, it's act.everytown.org /sign/fatal-gaps, and every town for gun safety. This is what this is about. This is the gun safety. So select your state. There's a big map all in yellow and burgundy and orange. you know, that you can pick which state you live in and see the worst performing states to the best performing states. And the worst are burgundy and the best are yellow. And, you know, some variation of in between. And so anyway, fatal gaps. Can dangerous people buy guns in your state? Every day, 33 Americans are murdered and 53 people kill themselves with guns. This is tragic. This is me interjecting. This is tragic. This is horrible. This is terrible. If you're listening and you're somebody who is in one of these kinds of positions, please, you know, reach out and find some natural supports. And talk to people and know that you can, like many of us have, gotten through this, and that you're not alone, and that there are organizations like Mind Freedom and like the Alliance and groups all over the country, Icarus Project. I mean, there's just tons of groups, Freedom Center, all kinds of things. If you just Google psychiatric survivor stuff, it will come up, and you will get linked into communities. But even still, this is a small portion of the larger amount of violence that our culture is experiencing right now, and we are a small, and it would be wonderful if we were none of the number of people who are represented by this, and that there wasn't people that were doing this, obviously. Like, that would be ideal. But we're not the people that are overwhelmingly responsible for this. However, on this fatal gaps, can dangerous people buy guns in your state? It says, too often the people pulling the trigger were able to arm themselves because of gaps in our background check system. We can only stop people who are dangerously mentally ill from buying guns if every gun sale includes a background check. And those background checks will only be effective if states submit hundreds of thousands of mental health records still missing from the system. Every missing record is another tragedy waiting to happen. And there's the drumbeat, you know, violence, loss of civil liberties. We're going to talk about loss of civil liberties. We better make people afraid that something bad's going to happen if we don't do this. So the report on this is called Closing the Gaps, Every Town's new report on the background check system. And New York apparently is one of the top 10 highest performing states for submitting mental health records. However, there are still tens of thousands of records missing from even the top performing states. And it looks like it says that there were 218,487 mental health records submitted in New York State. And they said it matters because 353,064 gun background checks were conducted. I don't know why they see this as a correlation or anything, but, you know, the idea that 218,000, do you realize that it's that high? 218,487 people, it seems, in New York State, that their records were turned in. 200 and this is the thing that I think John Allen is coordinating. I don't know. I could be totally wrong about this, but if this is partially through what's happening at the New York Safe Act, in New York, the Office of Consumer Affairs Director is handling this and overseeing this database of 218,487 mental health records submitted to the government in New York State. 218,000. Okay, so where are all of these people? You want to talk to me? Call me at area code 267-521-0167. And the toll-free line, 855-346-3351. There's a whole bunch of people who are listening in on the phone right now. Hello, I hope you're having a great night. If you want to talk to me at any point, make sure to hit 1 so I know to pull you into the conversation. But, like, really, I want to know how is 218,487 mental health records submitted in New York already? Let's see, if we went over to California, Holy cripe. California is also one of the top 10 highest performing states for submitting mental health records. However, there are still tens of thousands of records missing. And so apparently California submitted 563,458 mental health records to the government. Whoa, 563,458 records. And they did 1,368,295 gun checks. And so gun background checks. But they submitted 563,000. I'd like to know, like, what percentage of these gun checks are they obviously turning up? Like, as if having a psychiatric history is somehow a pre-qualifier for buying a gun. Are they crazy? Like, this is so nonsensical. It really is just such a problem. Let's see, what other states? See if we could see what D.C. did. In D.C., it said 559 were submitted. Good job, D.C. Mental record health record submissions needed to join best performing states. So there are 4,554 turn-ins of mental health records being submitted to become a best performing state. They just need 4,554 more people they turn in, and then they're done. But, you know, they ran 497 gun checks, which I don't know why, again, this matters. So, D.C., you are not one of the top performing states, and you've only turned in 559 people versus California's 563,458 people and New York's 218,487 people. Let's see, New Jersey, wow, you are outrunning New York almost by twice. 411,879 mental health records submitted to, I guess it's the federal government. I guess it's the federal government. So congratulations, New Jersey. You are, I guess, also a top 10 highest performing states. If you want to talk to me, or not about this or anything else, call in area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. If you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. 202.
Yeah, Lauren, I just came on. I heard you mention the District of Columbia. Now, what are these records for? Because I know that people are coming in, because I'm PMing people on my Facebook page, because there are people from North and South Carolina trying to come in too. What are the records for?
These records, this is from a report that was done called Closing the Gaps, Every Town's New Report on the Background Check System. And it's a little confusing to me, but it's a interactive map on the web page. It doesn't open up into a new page. Hold on. The website is act.everytown.org, and it opens up into a act.everytown.org. /sign/fatal gaps. Hold on,
You mean these are records that the jurisdictions have submitted to the federal government for background checks?
Right, that different states have. And so apparently this, I just posted it on my page. Apparently there's this organization, and that they did a report, and the report is called Closing the Gaps. strengthening the background check system to keep guns away from the dangerously mentally ill. And it was published by Every Town for Gun Safety on May 22nd, 2014. Now, I'm not sure who the authors are of this, but I feel like I've run into something like this before that has something to do with either Murphy talking about it or TAC or somebody. I don't know exactly what the connection in my mind is, if they're just maybe referring to it or if the news just referred to it and it's all in there. So there's different places where you can, like, look at the full report and to see what records are missing in your state. They have a whole, that's where it is. So if you click on New York, it tells you that they turned in 218,487 mental health records to this federal government background check system. So this is probably NCIS. And this is some kind of lobbying organization, this everytown.org. And they have a letter that can go right to Governor Cuomo. And it says, Dear Governor, hundreds of thousands of records of prohibited purchasers are missing from the background check system, putting American lives at risk. I'm proud to live in a state that has acted to get prohibiting mental health records into the background check system. Please keep working to improve our laws and to ensure we submit all relevant records to the system. And so, you know, under the New York Safe Act, that's part of what Cuomo was pushing, right? This is all part of his national thing. But if you click on D.C., it says that 559 were submitted, and that if D.C. wants to join the best-performing states, like New York and California, they would need at least 4,554 more records submitted.
Well, you know something, it's very curious because Washington, D.C. has one of the strongest gun control laws, and also conditions here make it so, well, we can't buy guns because there's no one that sells them in the District of Columbia. If you want one, we have to go to a state like Virginia where they have gun shows where we can get as many guns as we want to. But legally, there is no one in the District of Columbia that sells guns. You can, most of the time, the people that have the legal right to carry a gun are usually ex-police officers, ex-FBI people, and whoever who live in the city. The most of the guns come from the illegal, most, you know, street guns come
right,
from people
right,
with,
right. Right, because you guys have
illegally. So, you know, I don't understand why this, and, you know, most of the, Lauren, you brought this up on your show several times, you know, but most of the people in these horrendous cases where somebody has been shot or they've had a massacre, most of those people got the guns legally. So I don't see where the background checks are going to do any good except for to, you know, send to people, you know. I mean, what is the background check going to do? I mean, you got a background check, you're going to try to find out what is it? Whether they have a criminal record or whether they have a mental health record. I don't understand it.
Right, because if you have a mental health record, then you can't get a gun.
So the federal government has a database of people who have mental illness?
Well, yeah, that's what's happened. That's one of the things that was so scary of when they were pushing through this New York Safe Act that people were really talking about. Wait a second. Like, this is creating a national database of people who have psychiatric histories. So you can't go from state to state anymore. Now you got to, you know, and one of the other things that the New York Safe Act did is it made it so that you couldn't go county to county. So there's
a
state
database. Oh, wow, that's dangerous.
There's a state database,
too.
Yeah.
That's really dangerous. So, I think about, I had an incident with a neighbor, and I thought about getting a gun, but I said no. But so that people are not going to be able to go and get, to have a just reason to have a gun, just simply because they might have mental health history.
Right. And like, let people know, I'm the last thing I would have ever considered myself would be a proponent for guns. Do you know what I mean? Like, I am so not a gun person. But this is unconstitutional.
Because they're look at, in a database, they're not going to be able to look at each individual case. Because they won't be able to say that, well, Jane Jones, she's never been, you know, adjudicated or whatever else. I mean, this is bad news.
Under the New York SAFE Act, yeah, it's really, really bad. And the director of the New York Office of Consumer Affairs is who oversees the database for people who get turned in to. So it's my understanding that somewhere along the line they wipe out the actual reason why the call was made on the person, and that they don't get their actual records, just that they have a psychiatric history. So that's the other thing, is that just having a psychiatric history now it's like, oh, psychiatric history, oh, you're a dangerous person. You need to be double-checked. We need to come check in on you and make sure you don't have any, you know, like, whatever. Like, this is so wide-reaching, Yvonne. I mean, nobody will escape this. You have a history of depression or, like, the new...
They're looking in my medical records.
Yeah.
You've been looking in my medical records.
Oh, am I? I've been looking at your medical records? No, I don't work for the government.
But, you know, I put my stuff out publicly. But you know, this is really bad because, you know, I think that what happens is people think that people are way out here, that we don't want to protect society from people who, you know, have monstrous behavior. But there's no way to predict.
No.
And I know you have that training. Is there any test or anything to predict whether, even if a person, whether they have a mental illness or not, to predict whether they're going to
prep flags. I wish I could find that. I wish maybe I can find it now. I wish I could find that picture, because I had taken a picture of one shot because I was like, it's just a matter of time before I get turned in, before one of my, you know, coworkers says, wait a second. It was a really problematic on so many levels of this training of what they call red flags, that people, you know what it was? I made it one of my cover photos. Let's see if I can organize it like this. Folks, you get to see how my system works right on live.
I know you're going to get mad when you're saying this, Lauren, but it would make more sense if they, I know that when they say past performance is no predictor of the future in the stock market. You know, it would make more sense that they if they wanted to prevent gun violence, that they not go after people who have a diagnosis, because, you know, the data says that it's the exact opposite. It would seem as though you go after people who are like serial domestic violence, because we know that if a police officer goes to the house several times and the person has a gun, and they're violent toward their spouse or children, it's a more of a chance that person is going to have some kind of perpetuate some kind of gun injury on their loved one than to single out people who have to have a diagnosis.
Well, here's what they have as the red flags in this training I once went through. It was, although difficult to predict, some behaviors present red flags of potentially violent incident. These include, in the order that they're listed, a history of emotional or mental disturbance or threatening or violent behavior, in the same bullet point, alienation from other employees, sympathy for the perpetrator in publicized accounts of violence, sudden decrease in productivity or decline in personal hygiene, extreme stress from a life crisis, and an obsession with weapons. Don't ignore these behaviors. If a coworker, student, or visitor presents strong red flags, report it to your supervisor, department chair, or the office of public safety office.
Well,
a history of emotional
time,
or mental disturbance or threatening or violent behavior.
I said, I guess no wonder some of the behavioral health staff kind of stepped several feet away from me. But, you know, except for, I don't think that, I mean, they're red flags, so if you see this, who are you going to report it to?
Either the chair of the department or the Office of Public Safety.
Oh, this is at the university?
Yeah.
Now, you know, I said this last night, you know, East Germany, during the Cold War era, one out of every three East Germans was spying on each other. So,
right.
What we're going to have is a hyper-vigilant society that now has to listen to every comment you make in the workplace, determine to say, well, I should be on the side of caution and report it. Is that what you're saying?
That's certainly the messaging that this particular training gave. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what the danger is. I mean, I've even, and I'm on, like, a lot of adjunct listservs and things like that, professor listservs, whatever. And so, like, it's a regular conversation of where people are, like, debating at what point am I invading on somebody's, like, you know, if somebody is writing about something that is disturbing to me, that I'm supposed to now turn them in. And, you know, they're like English professors, like literature professors, you know, and they're like, but it's fiction. Like, it's supposed to be disturbing. It's supposed to be, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, we're talking about, like, real human emotional experience. Like, if somebody really understands that and can write that, that's somebody who needs to be, like, you know, supported and like, let them grow because they get what it is they're talking about. Like, I don't know. So, but I think that part of what's most problematic to me is that the first line, you know, because these are all bullet points, and it's a history of emotional or mental disturbance or threatening or violent behavior, all in the same bullet point. So, first of all, the history of emotional or mental disturbance by itself is fraud. You know what I mean? Like, as if that has some kind of predicting capacity for violence in the future. But to lump it in with or threatening or violent behavior, right there in the midst of it, so the drumbeat is already sent. And now all of a sudden, so it's okay if I, like, notice that, oh, you know, there's that one employee over there that, you know, used to get along with everybody, but now all of a sudden, like, people aren't really, like, speaking to this employee anymore. And so maybe they're a target. Maybe I should, like, report that, you know, X doesn't really talk to Y and Z anymore. You know what I mean? Like, at what, you know, and sympathy for perpetrator. If anybody, like, says anything, like, in any kind of sympathy for, like, Adam Lanza or, like, that poor kid, he was a kid. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. You know, one thing is this. This is very dangerous because I think what happens is they're minimizing people who are really dangerous. So if I have this thing, I know other people might disagree. I have a thing. If someone says, whether it's workplace or school, if they say that they're going to kill you, I think you should believe it. I mean, you know, unless it's on a, you know, off-cuff manner. And I think that by throwing in the mental health thing, it diminishes when people are actually making threats.
Yeah, and when people are actually making threats, like, that's a crime,
Like,
that's a crime. It's not a mental
health. You can't get in somebody's head and figure out what they're gonna do. But if someone says, "Look, you know, I'm gonna blow you the F away," you know. Those things should be taken seriously. And I think by this coupling of mental illness, in quotes, that's their language, quote, or people with label diagnosis with violence. I think what they're doing is they're doing a disservice for public safety, because it should be that if you say you're going to do it, if you've got a history of violating your family members or other people, you should be taken more seriously about that. I mean, your mental, emotional distress is not a predictor of whether a person is going to be a perpetrator. In fact, it's obvious. It's probably an indicator that you're probably going to be hurt. Most of the people that I know when I was...
By actual the research, they've shown that people are 14 times more... Brecky showed that at least 14 times more likely to be a victim of a crime than a perpetrator if you have a psychiatric history. And so...
That's the number one thing people coming out the hospital. The people that I have talked to that, which I do this quite often, I'm not an employee of the hospital or anything like that, or of the behavioral health. That's the number one complaint people have, that their fear of leaving institutions is they say that it's the normals who are violent toward them.
Yeah.
And so it's the exact opposite.
And it's fraud, and it's like defrauding the people. It's like criminal that they would be able to do it. And now that they've got these national databases. I mean, this is the other thing. This affects. Don't think for 2 seconds that this isn't, you know, once insurance companies have access to this, I'm sure. Do you know what I mean? Then you're just in already multiple category. Rerouting the data back out, to all these other agencies and organizations and people, and people don't realize that this is exactly, you know, where they had people watching, where your neighbor. Well, how do you think they knew your neighbor knew? Because
and everybody is not going to be abide by those privacy laws. Now, a lot of people don't, you have to think about it. For example, when you go for a job, I've had some people say this to me, why is it they want to get my credit report? You know, I said, that's because they say that if you got bad credit, you know, you might steal from your boss or something else, especially if you have a security clearance. But now, if you're collecting a database like that, you know, the fact that other people that have no reason to know, they can find out whether you've seen a psychiatrist or not. I'm old enough to remember when Eagleton, when there was all the talk about him being on a ticket with McGovern, and because he had had ECT, he was no longer a viable vice president. Suppose you're in your company and you're up for a mid-level management position. And, you know, you happen to have gone, you know, umpteen years ago for some brief counsel. Or either you're seeing somebody now, or availing yourself of service. That could be used against you in the future. So, you know, collecting this information on people who have different contacts with healthcare providers is very dangerous. If you are a person who seeks out to get life insurance. I just give you an example now. Everyone knows that when they go for a whole life policy, they do count them another kind of check. It's sort of like a check that they do for credit, but they do this to find out whether you've got any pre-existing conditions. So if you have some things in your background, mental health, and they can tell from your prescriptions, you may not be able to get that whole life policy, or you may have to pay a higher premium. So this has the potential of doing the same thing, interfering with your ability to get maybe into a certain universities might have to use it. Employers have to use it. I mean, there are going to be other people that will be able to use this besides, it's a slippery slope, and I hate to say Congressman Barber said on the Diane Reeves show, when they start getting into this kind of stuff, of collecting this information.
Yes, but he has no problem with it, and he funds it, and he votes for it. He has no problem with it. He funds it. He votes for it. He supports it. He says it's a slippery slope, and he still does it. And so,
you know.
I mean, I think that that's the thing, and that he's responding from experience. Somebody put that post up about responding, that force is a response of having been traumatized on some level of working with this, and that your response is that you want to then force people into stuff because you think that it's going to have some kind of, it would have had a better outcome if that person had been forced into services, not realizing that, like, the psychiatry very often makes it worse. And the only parts of these things that people ever really say that they benefit from are things like being able to have a place to live or a job to go to. And those aren't psychiatric issues. Those are not, that is not something that the psychiatric profession should be handling out and determining, like, where people can live with who and why and everything else. It should be just
well, that's really very intrusive to be able to mandate these things because, you know, the people that don't have contact with the character of mental health system, mental health public system, don't understand the degree that when you have something like AOT, when you have that place, I don't think, a lot of people just think it's off base that we're talking fantasy land, but, you know, a judge in a mental health court or someone doing an AOT order, they have a high degree of latitude of telling a person what they can do. And some things that many people don't really think, well, how is that going to have anything to do with treatment? They don't understand that. And that, you know, you can, I know where I live, we have about 3 mental health courts. And they even have a clinic in the court itself.
Yeah. And I mean, in the Murphy bill, it says on page 19, the use of the grant, an assisted outpatient treatment program carried out with a grant awarded under this section shall include, 1, evaluating and seeking out eligible individuals. We're going to evaluate and seek out. So ordinarily, right? But there are going to be, so this grant can be used to evaluating and seeking out eligible individuals who may benefit from assisted outpatient treatment. 2, preparing and executing treatment plans for eligible patients and filing petitions for assisted outpatient treatment in appropriate courts. So people can get paid to evaluate you and to find you and to prepare what your treatment plan should be and to file all of your paperwork for your court date. And then they also can get paid for providing case management services to eligible patients who are participating in the program to provide such patients with resources, monitoring, and oversight, including directly monitoring a participant's level of compliance and the delivery of services by other providers pursuant to the court order. And 4, carrying out referrals and medical evaluations and paying the cost of legal counsel for commitment orders to be submitted and evaluated by the courts. That's all the things that this grant in the Murphy bill does. And then, of course, they have a data collection section. And this is, the grantees under this section shall provide in a timely fashion any data collected pursuant to the grant to the National Mental Health Policy Laboratory as requested by the Assistant Secretary concerning health outcomes and treatments.
And so, national whatever. What did you just say?
Yeah. This is what I'm talking about, Iman. Everybody is talking about the Murphy bill, and nobody is actually talking about what the Murphy bill is saying. And the Murphy bill is saying that this is all to set up a National Mental Health Policy Laboratory as requested by the, and set up an Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services that must be either a medical doctor who's had a residency in psychiatry or a clinical psychologist who's done both a clinical work and research to oversee SAMHSA, and that what they're doing is they're going to wipe out everything SAMHSA does, and they're going to include all of these new things and create this National Mental Health Policy Laboratory, which acronym is NMHPL. Oh, if you didn't hear me, because you said you had just called in, right? So you might not have even heard any of this at the beginning. I was reading all of this an hour ago, and it's infuriating when, you know, why, and all people are talking about, oh, they're going to cut PRM programs. They're not going to cut PRM programs. They are going to absolutely galvanize out this system and put in something that winds up paying for, you know, all of these other things, including assisted outpatient treatment, but also these other screenings that I talked about before, like the autism screening, that if you get two things wrong, that you're being told that you need to go to a doctor and get your kid evaluated on a 20-question scale.
That should be in legislation in the first place. We had something similar to this in Washington, because our behavioral health system was been under court orders for, you know, 30, 40 years. In fact, they just got from under it. I was the only
person. Right, because you were in receivership, right?
We were in receivership, and then we got out. We had a master. In fact, I was the only person, recovery group, the only organization that sent a letter to Judge Hogan asking them not to get us out from under the court case. Now, one of the things that can happen is, and it's a good and a bad thing, when a judge says that they have to do something, usually what happens is the mental health system has to do it. However, unless there are extra dollars that are there, that means the judge all of a sudden becomes, I know you're going to have a show on that, the judge has so much power that he's telling mental health that, look, you've got to service this person. So two things happen.
Yes, and that'll be, go ahead.
Those services that the court says usually take priority. So anything else that those who, you know, really believe that people need those services, that they're providing services, they will suffer. So if you have something going on that has been working very well for people, the people who have to divvy up resources will have to say, will say, we have a priority because we have X number of clients that are under court order, and their court orders require that they have this and that. That takes precedence over what you, whether a social worker, a psychiatrist. This is very nice that you're helping X number of people, but we can't do this month, or we're going to cut back because we've got to do that. That's one thing that happens. The second thing that happens is because people think that there is some kind of way that people are going to get better service. People lie to get their family members into assisted outpatient treatment. I believe that this is where a lot of people are going with this. They don't understand that the dollars aren't there. So what you have is, in many times, adult persons who have diagnosis, who have family members, who believe that they should be in treatment, or that they're not aggressively enough in treatment, they may already be in treatment, they will lie
right,
so that they will have assisted outpatient treatment orders. And it,
right, and what this grant does for under Murphy is it puts all of this funding into the front end, into them finding you, evaluating you, making a treatment plan, filing a petition, paying for your court fees. But to the best I can see, I mean, unless that's in the entire way that they're restructuring the Medicaid, Medicare stuff, you know, where the money is going is into the front end. It's not going into services, because this is a legal, this is just a legal thing. This is not a treatment program.
Not a service. And that's why people who the people who believe in mental health, who believe in services, that's why they should be just as concerned as people who see psychiatry as a human rights issue. That's why they should be, because what they do is going to fundamentally change. Now, a lot of times people say, well, we already have that here. But when you bump something up to now it's federal, It's not a yeah. state anymore.
Oh, but this is all in the Murphyville. This is what I mean. Nobody is talking about. I mean, they're talking about like, oh, they're going to cut SAMHSA, but they're not talking about like what they're going to wind up doing, and how this is going to wind up falling out. I mean, even with PAMI, like subtitle E is Section 1141, prohibition against lobbying by systems accepting federal funds to protect and advocate the rights of individuals with mental illness. Right. So obviously the language is terrible. But, you know, so no lobbying, no hiring lobbyists, no anything like that, no using funding to engage in systemic lawsuits or to investigate or seek legal remedies or anything. And C, counseling. This makes it illegal. Wait, this is the topper. This makes it illegal for a PAMI to do any, quote, counseling an individual with a serious mental illness who lacks insight into their condition on refusing medical treatment or acting against the wishes of such individual's caregiver.
We need to back all this up because, you know, you say this so quickly, everybody may not understand it. Now, you said
on page 133 of the Murphyville. I'm going to put it online right now. This is
133. Well, question, why did they put this in there? I thought that when you couldn't use federal funds for lobbying anyway. Are they just saying that you can't lobby, period, even if you can't use even if you use another money?
Right. If you're taking federal money at all, I think.
Wow. So, because right now, I don't think any of the PNAs use any money. Because a lot of the PNAs are made up of attorneys. And they know this very well. There is no such thing as using federal dollars for lobbying.
Right. No, but this other thing, that's not my issue. Isn't around the lobbying. My issue is around Section C, that counseling an individual with a serious mental illness who lacks insight into their condition on refusing medical treatment or acting against the wishes of such individual's caregiver. Protection and advocacy is now got to worry about acting against the wishes of the caregiver. Isn't that who they're supposed to be protecting this person against?
Yeah, but...
Or whatever the right word is there. So why now is it illegal? If Murphy's bill passes, if you work for a PAMI or work for an organization that gets federally funding to do protection and advocacy...
You won't be doing nothing.
You counsel somebody in a way that is different than what the service provider wants or the caregiver, the family member wants?
So, let's break this down a little bit. So if I'm going to, let's say, XYZ agency in the District of Columbia and I get my services, and I, because the PAMIs don't go out and try to recruit people. But I come to you and I say, I need help.
Right.
Because I'm trying to tell my provider that I don't want to take this particular medication because it's, you know, I go to my primary care doctor and he tell me if I keep taking this, my kidneys are going to get shut down. And I don't want to take it anymore. You know.
Right.
That means that I can't go, I'm poor, I'm on Social Security disability. I can't go to nobody to get no help because they say, I'm sorry, Yvonne, I'd love to help you, but, you know, my hands are tied. You have a diagnosis and, you know, you need this medication for your mental health.
And you lack insight, Yvonne. Yvonne, this is just part of it. Let me explain this to you. If you had a stroke and you thought you could move your hand, but you weren't able to, and you can't tell because your brain is damaged, and this is just part of what happens, and this is what it's like, and so you just need to accept that you don't have insight into your condition, and refusing medical treatment is not a good idea, and you should be lucky that you have a caregiver, and you know, and I'm so glad you called Protection and Advocacy today. Have a nice day.
Yeah, well, you know something, this is another step that's going over. Because in most people's cases, as adults, I thought you have a, even if you, you have the right to refuse treatment. I mean, unless you're going to die. I mean, I don't know anybody who, I mean, if I, wow, this is really off the charts here. So if, so a person can't refuse, can't get help. That's what they think and refuse. But they cannot get help to formulate, to get from out from under.
And
this.
That is seen, that is under the section prohibition against lobbying. That's not lobbying.
That's not lobbying. That's doing your protection job. That's why I object to this, because the federal government has been a protector of people, vulnerable people, whether it's around civil rights or human rights, you know, ethnic groups, other people that have been put, added in, whether it's GBLT, whatever else, people that have disabilities have protected. And so it's, it appears that this mercy bill is just taking all of that and throwing it out the trash and just saying, look, the caregiver's rights, the caregiver's rights, your adult family member's rights take precedent over your individual rights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
so that,
in subtitle F, the limitations on authorities. So the very first one is limitations on SAMHSA programs. No sponsoring conferences. So this is where the alternatives conferences under attack. And people, if you want to see the actual language of this, this also is on page 133 of the bill. So the Administration of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration shall not host or sponsor any conference that will not be primarily administered by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration without giving at least 90 days of prior notification to the Committee on Energy and Commerce and the Committee on Appropriations of the House of Representatives and the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions and the Committee on Appropriations of the Senate. And evidence-based practices, the Administrator of Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration shall not provide any financial assistance for any program relating to mental health or substance use diagnosis or treatment, unless such diagnosis and treatment relies on evidence-based practices. So that's what wipes out all of the PR programs. And that's on page 133, folks. So when you keep on hearing that people are talking about that the SAMHSA conference is going to get cut and all the alternative stuff is going to get cut, that's what they're talking about.
Well, I think what happens is people don't understand that also how Washington works. If you have all of these committees, they have to have oversight. You'll never have an alternative conference to come out. I'll give you an example. Everybody heard about Benghazi and the complaints that they had about the former Secretary of State and why they didn't have more people there. But what they don't play up very handily, and I'm so upset not doing it, is that the reason why they didn't have more people there is because the money had been appropriated, but they had a committee in Congress that had to say, yes, you can go ahead and use that money. So the same thing can happen for alternatives. That did happen for NAPA's conference about 2 years ago. In other words, you could have money allocated for something, but if you have something in law saying that they have to check with all these various committees, and Congress, believe me, they work very, very slow. So you could have some a year from now, they could say for the 2015 alternative, they could say, oh, yes, it's been allocated, but if it's got to go through these different committees, you know, it may be till the week of when the conference is supposed to take place that all the checkoffs are given.
Yeah, but remember,
you know?
Murphy chairs, the very first committee it's got to go through is Energy and Commerce, and that's the committee that Murphy chairs. I guess he thinks he's going to be there forever. Maybe just until he takes over the presidency, you know.
Freeman, this is a bad thing. I'm just saying that how it plays out is somebody might say, this is where people say, well, you can't be so militant about it. You know, they have a right to oversight. Well, the thing about it is if you know how these systems work, What they're doing is they're stopping you in your tracks. It's the same thing about having the overlord for Sansa. You know, like you said last night, you know, it's ridiculous for anyone to say that Sansa's anti-psychiatry or anything
right.
other medical model. I mean, those are people that really don't know. I mean, that's a false attack because they're not. They're very much.
And it's
so.
An insult. It's an insult to anti-psychiatry to suggest that these people are anti-psychiatry. It's an abomination. It needs to be corrected. And quite frankly, all of these people out there, instead of getting mad at me for talking about the values of what this movement started on, should be saying, hey, yeah, look, you want to hear anti-psychiatry? That's anti-psychiatry. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I don't. You're really not anti-psychiatry because anti-psychiatry would be really be we would be having our own bills to take down a lot of this that's been going on. But you have to really dissect because I know that when you have read the document and you keep up with this stuff, you know it, and then it's so when you hear people making these misstatements. It's very insulting. But the fact is that they make these statements and people hear it on radio and TV. And like I said, between now and probably we can guarantee that there's going to be some other incident that's going to propel this in the next 30 days. That's why I say that, you know, people get relaxed. They say, oh, that's died down now. It's not died down because...
No, it's they're in the process. I mean, hell... What Murphy's own people said in that article that I was reading from the other day, yesterday or the day before, about this merger, all in response to that MHO, Mental Health America article, Murphy himself said that they're going to be writing up the, you know, crafting the language over the 4th of July recess. So, you know, here's to your liberty, folks. This is what we're going to be doing on the 4th of July. We're going to figure out exactly how we're going to be able to get away with taking as many civil liberties away from as many of you as possible. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's all that happened. That's all this reaching out to the other side to try to get, you know, quote-unquote Democrats to support this stopping from happening. All they did was strengthen Murphy because now they've got a whole other cartel of people that they would have never been working with otherwise.
Wait a minute. You say that by stopping Murphy...
By stopping Murphy? No, by going to Barber, by trying to get the Democrats to write a bill. Like, the Democrats have ever written a bill that has protected us. All they do is throw more services at us. When a Democrat is in charge, the amount of money that's poured into psychiatry grows. The Republicans, at least, don't want to spend money, so sometimes it even gets cut back. But this is, you know... But what they're doing, regardless, is not just limited to this. I don't know, were you on when I was talking about the veterans courts that they're setting up in the Murphy bill?
Yeah, I heard that last night, yeah. The veteran courts. Yeah, I think that's all this is bad news. But what happens, people have to hear it all together, and they have to hear it often, is that many people, like I said, many people don't know. Probably the people that listen to this radio show do know that they have mental health courts. But they will, all this is an attempt to, I guess, you know, people look to their legislators for some kind of help when they have a veteran that's out of control or whatever. But the thing about it, as you say, none of this is going to put a roof over someone's head. And that's what people need. People want roof over their head. They want jobs. If you got a veteran, They need support. They have their own little peer system or whatever else. You know, they're not
like
getting
what Paula Kaplan is doing, and with the when Johnny and Jane come marching home stuff, and even Mary Ellen Copeland with the veterans' rap plans that there are alternatives. But what our government is planning on doing and is doing is putting, you know, implanting electronic devices into veterans' brains to be able to better control their chemical, electrical impulses.
Well, you know something, Lauren, you have to think about this now. The government has been involved over a decade now in a war. Just hear me out a minute. They've been involved. They have trained people to be killers. You know, and these are some of the side effects when you go to war, is that you have people who are damaged by them. And we people made promises after World War II and Korea that said that we would take care of veterans. But what has happened is in the last 50 or 60 years, it's just like with just like in civil rights, an insufficient check for veterans. An insufficient check. It's been covered up. It's part of their culture or whatever. I mean, you're not even talking about mental health services. They can't get physical health services. So, you know, they have
and now they're going to have to go through mental health screenings before they're going to be allowed to get physical health. Watch, I bet you. I bet you it's going to get worse. I bet you more people are going to wind up dying. This is terrible. This is terrible.
Well, you know, like I said, more people need to come to the side. Like I said, need to come and realize that these measures affect everybody because it's a creep. It's a creep. You have mental health courts, CIT, which some people thought was a good idea. And I never was for CIT, never.
Yeah, me either.
They use the police to, that's all right if you live in a small town, like Andy of Mayberry, you live in a small town where everybody knows each other and you know the guy. You know the people there. But most people don't live in those kinds of environments. Police
right.
are used to sweep the streets. They're used for gentrification. In large cities, they're used to take out homeless, to take out other people. And even they don't do a very effective job because they still don't have no place to bring them. There's no database. There's no
right.
mental health court to provide housing for people, employment,
but,
or anything like that.
Yeah, and the last thing we need is more of it.
Make them homeless.
But I wanna just bring in area code 803. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. I'm really enjoying this show. I never heard it till last night, and it's a really great show, and it's really great discussion.
Thanks. What's your name?
Gareth.
Gareth?
Yeah, I got a weird name. My mom thought it was a girl's name, but it's actually a boy's name. But anyway, it's my name. Anyway, hi. And I just wanted to say something about the Murphy bill.
Sure.
Yeah, I read the whole bill. I mean, not every single word, but I basically read the whole bill when it was first dropped in the hopper last fall. And kind of my impression on this is that Murphy is just totally lined up with Tory and Jaffe, and the three of them are, like, concentrating like a laser beam all of this messaging. It's very powerful and unified message, and I think the reason why, one of the reasons why they're being very successful is I think we're at a turning point in history where there's like a national consensus that the system that we have is totally broken and totally not working. And that Murphy, Tory, Jaffe has their answer. And then on the other side, everybody is all in disarray and chaos. And what I would like to see, and I don't know how it could happen, would be for, a really coherent, powerful message that goes counter to them. But, I personally think it's got to come from including people that believe in mental health services, which I do. I think that people who believe in mental health services need to get together and speak together in one unified kind of way, because I need to know what the message is in order to talk like with legislators and be effective. If everybody's just kind of going off on their own, it's not going to be effective, and the legislators don't know how to respond to the public
if people are
attacking each other.
I think that that's There are plenty of places where people who believe in this crap can do that. This is not one of those places. This is one of those places where we're trying to figure out how to dismantle the whole thing and to, you know, to get people who believe in this fraud to understand that there is no evidence behind it. And so if you, for people who want this stuff, for them to want it is fine and use it is fine. I could care less what drugs people do. I think people should be able to do with informed consent and choice whatever drugs they want, but not call it a biological, you know, mental illness, quote-unquote, when there's absolutely zero evidence of a, quote-unquote, mental illness actually existing. And so I think that that's where it gets really hairy.
I got a question here. It's possible, isn't it possible that people who believe that the whole mental health system needs to be turned out, you know, I was talking about people quitting it, and then that the people who do believe in some resurgence, some of those people call themselves reformers, that they all could agree that the Murphy Bill is bad and that they fight against it. Is it possible that that
would
happen?
Well, that's what originally happened, and then a division of those people decided that instead of just trying to stop Murphy Bill, that they were going to try to start another bill that would, and so that's why we're now trying to fight two bills. Because there was a point when everybody agreed that we were just going to try to stop this thing from happening. And then some point along the way, somebody thought, oh, well, maybe we should go get them to write a counter bill. And so the counter bill also includes all kinds of prevention and early intervention and screenings and targets young people and young adults in a much more significant way.
Lauren, the fact is that they are going to have some kind of bill because of all these killings and stuff. We know that they don't help anything, but people feel like they got to do something. So they are going to have something, but we certainly don't want to have the thing
something
that
was
you talked.
Squash that bill. The something was get your senators and representatives to say no to signing on to the Murphy bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now they've got Murphy and Barber working together across the aisle. So something definitely will get put in now. Whereas before, there was at least the partisan issue that we could have wrote out on.
Well, it's the same as it is what it is right now. But it's like affordable health care, which has been voted against, I don't know how many times, 43, 44 times, and it's still there. I mean, it's not perfect. But it's still there. And
this is a result of that.
Well.
Yeah. I mean.
As a caller. Who was the person on the call?
Gareth?
Are you still there?
Me? Gareth? Is that who you're talking to?
Gareth?
Yeah. Yes, my name
is
Gareth. Are you talking to me?
This person, yeah. Okay, yeah. But this bill, whether it's Murphy or the Barber bill, I don't know if it's, you know, it still could be possible that both of those bills be squashed.
Well, that would be ideal.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I think, you know, the issue of reform versus abolition goes back for centuries. And, you know, when it gets bad
business. It's a billion-dollar business, and as Gareth said, the defilatory and Jaffe and other people, and you say this too, Lauren, it's a billion-dollar business. And
trillion. I know. Trillions of dollars. And if
trillions
worldwide,
of dollars. And
it is, but I do agree, Gareth. I do agree, Gareth, that Tory and Jaffe and Tack are behind this, and they're the problem. And I do think that Tory should be losing his license and not being allowed to present this information as fact when it's not.
You know he's teaching other doctors. You know You know, Tori is a teacher of the Uniformed Services School, which
right.
is where all the military service doctors, where they go. You knew
right.
that, right?
Yes, I know
yes.
that.
So
well,
he's further spreading his gospel, too.
Gareth, are you trying to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to say that I'm totally against Tory and Jaffe. And at the same time, I do believe in mental health services, and I think that one of the phenomena that's going on is that people like myself who are more, I don't know what to call it, moderate or in the middle or wanting to reform things, what I have observed, and I know this to be a fact, is there is a lot of people in kind of my camp who are very respectful of and honoring of people that experience mental health services as just trauma and outrage and oppression and injustice, and trying to respect those perspectives are, you know, very, don't want to, you know, steamroller over people who want to ruin the whole thing and don't want to, you know, don't want to re-traumatize people who are speaking out in their completely authentic way, you know? And the thing is that Tori and Jaffe, they have no such scruples whatsoever. They just go through and do their thing and power it through, and they have a very message. Whereas,
so Gareth, what do you think the purpose, what do you think their purpose is? Let me ask you that. What do you think that, what is the mission of Tori and Jaffe? What's their mission?
Well, I guess you have to decide whether you think that they're like evil people or whether you think they sincerely believe in what they're doing. I don't think they're insincere evil people. I think that they are people who believe they're doing the right thing, and the right thing that they believe in is evil. I mean, there's, I think that
you
they believe,
believe
that they're doing right. I think they believe they're doing right.
No, I'm not asking that. What I'm asking you, do you believe, what I'm asking you is, what do you believe their mission is? Not whether they believe they're do-gooders or not. What do you believe their mission is?
They want to have the state, the government, be more powerful and controlling over individuals that they think are mentally ill. They want more government control.
So they want to control people's lives? Would you safely
yeah.
say that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And these are all these people are, most of them are adults?
I think they want to control everybody. But I think they, you know, their focus is on people diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar. They're really into this whole thing about lack of insight, and they focus in on a particular subgroup of people that they put a circle around that they would diagnose with schizophrenia or bipolar or these conditions that they say you don't have insight. That's the people, that's a very specific target group that they are trying to control.
Okay, but in the Murphy
that
bill,
anybody can fall into, because they have no actual physical evidence of any of this existing, and the cincher of their evidence is you saying that they're wrong, right? So just for anybody listening.
But both of you have said you've read the bill in its entirety. The bill, does it, these measures, these draconian measures, do they specifically say people who have schizophrenia or bipolar, do they outline that, or do they use other general terms?
It's been a while since I actually looked at the paper. I think Lauren has it right there in front of her.
No, they
mm-hmm.
use mostly, I mean, they will say serious mental
terms.
Illness, but they, I'm just, all right, so the word let me just make sure I'm spelling this right, S-C-H-I-Z, schizophrenia does not come up. Bipolar does not come up. Serious mental illness does come up probably repeatedly.
Okay, so the reason why I ask this, because a lot of times what happens is we don't really look at something and what it says, because when people that we know come before these courts, they're not going to be parsing words about diagnosis. They're not going to be parsing words about that. And I understand where you're coming from, Gareth, because I used to come from that point of view too. But they're talking about everybody, and that's what the radio show is talking about, is to shed a light on. They're not talking about that small subgroup of people that I don't even like to use the word serious mental illness, who maybe tend toward violence. Because, you know, everyone would say we wish that Jared Loughner, we wish that Chow in Virginia, the guy in California, that somehow they could be stopped. But there is no way to predict who is going to do this. And so, therefore, when they use these general terms, everyone is going to be affected, even the people that are supposedly recovered, that had a past diagnosis. You know, people in Germany, there were many people who really thought that they could work with the Nazis until they came and took their property, took them and their family members away. And that's why I asked you, what do you think their purpose is? If their purpose is to control everyone, then no one is going to be exempt. I oftentimes hear stories. I talked about this last night, by someone who's people in a state hospital, of how they got there and why they're still there. And this could be Gareth, you, it could be me. If their purpose is to control everybody, it's not going to just be for people with schizophrenia.
Well, I mean, I think I would disagree with you. I don't believe that their purpose is to control everyone, but, you know, we can disagree on that.
Oh, but it is. It clearly is, because it includes now all kinds of levels. And so don't forget, they're also going after depression. They're going after, there are specific laws now in New York State for maternal depression. But the Murphy bill, the Murphy bill also includes autism. I don't know if you heard before when I was going through the screening that they're suggesting that should be used, that if you answer 2 of 20 questions wrong, that you're now considered medium risk and should go to your doctor and get your kid diagnosed with autism. This is far-reaching. What they're planning on doing with veterans, with seniors, with Medicaid and Medicare being entirely rewritten. I mean, these laws are just wildly expansive, and they're setting up national databases and the electronic medical records and the national reporting mechanisms. This is really, really bad business, Gareth.
They really wanted to help people. Let's put it this way. Let's say that mental health services, some people have been helped, okay, if you have that as a premise. Do you think that the mental health services where you are, do they have lots of money and all the resources they need?
I think there's, in this country, the most incredibly shocking, appalling inequalities. Some people have a huge amount of resources and other people have practically nothing. So it's hard to generalize.
No, what I'm saying is that by and large, would you think that most people who are, let's say, caregivers, do you think that they think they have all the resources that they need to help the people
No, I know for a fact not.
Okay, all right. So it would be much easier if instead of putting all these processes, judicial processes in place, actually what we're seeing is that they're taking, it's almost like Tory and Jaffe are whispering in Tim Murphy's ear. Or that their tax staff went over to his staff and wrote the bill for him. It would
be
much
easier. They did. I'm certain they did. That's not a conspiracy theory or anything. I know they did.
Okay. So you know they did. So, and we know where they come from. Anybody can go to the tac.org website and see what they're about. But it would have been very easy for them to have just put in a simple few-page bill to give additional resources in the block grant to the states. Would it not?
Are you asking me a question? I'm sorry.
Yes, I am.
If people really believe in services,
wouldn't it have been much easier to give a potload of money? Or even Murphy did not support affordable health care. Would it be much easier for true believers and that say mental health services do help some people, and that we don't have enough resources for those people to say, well, we don't need all this convoluted process and where we are using the judiciary, where we're collecting data on people. We know for a fact that you're under-resourced, and here's some additional resources for you.
I'm sorry, I lost the thread. Was there something I was supposed to respond to? I am so sorry.
Rather than write all that gobbledygook, is to say, here's a whole bunch of more money.
Because the analysis on the right, I'm going to call them the right, you can call them the Nazis or call them whatever you want. The analysis on that side, it's all Nazis. The analysis over on that side is giving out money for programs is failing, and the system is breaking down and totally failing at people who are the most, as they would see it, the most seriously affected, impaired, anosognostic, or whatever they call it, and violent. And that by spending large amounts of money to blanket with all kinds of supportive services that are voluntary, you're basically abandoning people who end up in prison.
But that's a fraud.
So they don't believe in giving out lots of money. They believe in targeting it on people that they see as the most severely ill. That's my understanding.
Which is a fraud.
Of their approach.
Which is a fraud. And so this idea that they're allowed to even put out the idea that there is such a thing as a serious mental illness when there's absolutely zero evidence of that existing, and not deal with oppression or other economic issues or education and job training or whether or not somebody has a home, things that psychiatry should not be in charge of on any level whatsoever. So it's just perpetuating the fraud, and it really is a violation of the human rights of people who are involved.
So I guess my question is there any way for those of us who believe that mental illness is a meaningful term and that mental illness actually exists, is there any way for people who believe in the mental illness construct and believe that mental health services are capable of helping at least some people, is there any way for us to proceed in a way that respects and collaborates with those who think the whole thing's a fraud, or do we need to just, accept that we're going to be working at cross purposes? I don't want to.
I feel like people who willingly use the language of mental illness knowing that there's absolutely no evidence of this thing existing are enemies. I feel like when somebody, and quite frankly, Yard, I did this myself for some period of time before I kind of like woke up to what the hell was going on around me 20 years ago. The idea that psychiatry has something to offer and that people, when they say that they're talking from a position of lived experience about it and use that kind of language and use that kind of rationale for it, I feel like they are enemies.
So given that you define me as your enemy, how should we then relate to each other? because we're both trying to kill the Murphy Bill. How should we relate to each other in society? I mean, I'm involved in a lot of, you know, stuff, activity, movement stuff, intellectual stuff, talking stuff, helping stuff. And, you know, it's very uncomfortable to me that I am defined by you as your enemy. So what should we do about it, if anything?
I think part of what needs to be done is that people need to stop slashing the credibility of people who are survivors of psychiatry and who want to see the system abolished. And I think that, you know, every time that somebody is raised to a position of power of where they're willing to switch their language to maintain their funding and that they admit openly that that is what they're doing, that they are my enemy. I'm not saying you are my enemy, but those people who are willingly doing that, who are willingly using language of quote-unquote mental illness to further their agenda, because using language of a lived experience or of a trauma survivor isn't what the people who are in power are looking for, I believe they are my enemy. They are cooperating in the oppression of our people, and civil rights movements do not trade off some things for others when they really are operating as civil rights movements.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's where
So I kind of go back to what do I do? I mean, I want to...
What you do Garrett. The Murphy Bill with all tooth nails, if you agree on things that you agree on, do you agree that the Murphy Bill is bad news, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. So, and Lauren, do you agree that the Murphy Bill is bad news?
Yes.
Okay. You don't have to agree on every little finite thing. The thing about it is that...
Well, there's some really big things we don't agree on.
You do have to... Some basic things, and one of the basic things is the Murphy Bill is bad for everyone.
But I think where people really wind up parting ways isn't around the beliefs of what they want to see stop happening. It's around the strategies and tactics in which the way that they think that should be done. And quite frankly, I think that there are so few people left who actually attain, stick to the original values of this movement that were certainly by 1982 set out in the Declaration of Principles. What fueled the entire thing getting to the attention of the federal government in the first place when the federal government bought the whole thing out.
And the human rights movement. Many people who listen to this don't know that, but that was the split that was there.
That is the movement that I am part of. I am not part of a consumer movement. I am not interested in preserving aspects of the peer industry or, you know, anything that grows this psychiatric system and the fraud when people have to be certified, you know, in terms of peer. The whole thing is an abomination of what it was supposed to be. And so I do not have a popular position on this, Gareth, but I am not alone. And the fact that the people who have the money have a position that's very often directly different than mine is evidence of the fact that I won't take I will not do the things that are required to do in order to have that kind of position. And I'm not willing to sell out aspects of certain things for others. And I am willing to die over things. And so, you know, metaphorically speaking, nonviolent.
Right now, the Murphy Bill still lives, and we still need to fight it.
I mean, I think
the Murphy Bill is,
you know,
around, and we still need to fight it.
And I just don't think that by, you know, trying to compromise where you can, that it's going to make it any better, because unfortunately, the people. All want to see the same thing, and none of them have any problem with us being forced into psychiatric anything. But, you know, all that being said, I am not, and you are not, and Yvonne is not, and no one is, just their position on this or that. And so how do we operate in the larger world? The same way we operate in the larger world around everything, if people are lucky. And, you know, you still can go and sit down and have a cup of coffee with somebody, even though you disagree differently. But I'm not going to be quiet about what I think needs to be done because somebody thinks that this thing should continue. We have, like, literally 20 seconds left. So, Gareth, Yvonne, everybody who's been listening all night, I want to thank you for calling in. And, Gareth, I hope that we can continue this conversation because I think you asked important questions and that these are things that have been going on in our movements for centuries. And I do think that we must stop the Murphy Bill at any cost. And so I'm going to ask you all to keep on speaking out. And until I talk to you next time, talk to you soon.